Welcome back to Issues Etc. Here's the third hour. I'm Todd Wilkin. My intrepid producer tells me that this perhaps is a record, 8 guests in the course of 3 hours. In this last hour, 4 guests all said. Karen Hayes will join us from Concerned Women for America of Illinois. We'll be talking about that Ronald Reagan bill that is in favor of embryonic stem cell research in the Illinois legislature. The key is the Senate. We'll be talking about that here in the first few minutes. Sherry Tyree, you read her commentary in today's St. Louis Post-Dispatch titled Tips for Pro-Choice Advocates. This is a very interesting column that I recommend you read. Whether you're pro-choice, especially if you're pro-life, too. She's co-founder of Women for Faith and Family. We'll also be talking with Diane Nippers of the Institute on Religion and Democracy about these guidelines from the National Association of Evangelicals on Political Action. That's about halfway through our conversation here in the last hour. And then we'll round off this last hour of Issues Etc. with Senator Sarah Steelman. We'll be talking about a vote in August on a proposed amendment for the Missouri Constitution to ban gay marriage. Of course, they had wanted the advocates of the amendment to the Missouri Constitution to ban gay marriage had wanted to get on the November ballot. That was blocked by the governor of Missouri. It will go on an August ballot. We'll find out what that means in the last few minutes of Issues Etc. today. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Karen Hayes is Associate Director of Concerned Women for America of Illinois. Karen, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi, Todd.
Tell us about this newly renamed bill, the Ronald Reagan Biomedical Research Act.
Well, Todd, we've been watching this bill, and as you mentioned, it already passed the Illinois House. We call it the Clone and Kill Bill. It's a funding bill for embryonic stem cell research. We've been fighting this all along, but when they went ahead and tried to cause a controversy, I guess. I guess they knew they were going to do this by renaming it after President Ronald Reagan. That was just an incredible step that the opposition took, because Ronald Reagan himself was very pro-life and would never, ever have been in favor of embryonic stem cell research. And there's been lots of discussion about this, but the record is clear that Ronald Reagan himself was pro-life all the way through from conception and would never have done this.
Now, Nancy Reagan recently was in the news as tossing her hat into the ring on the issue of embryonic stem cell research,
Right. Encouraging
with several other senators, actually a big handful of them, for the president to reverse his August 2001 decision that would have limited federal funding
Right. For
embryonic stem cell research and expanded the number of embryos that could be killed for their stem cells.
Right.
Is this one of the reasons that the lawmakers there in the State House decided that the Reagan name might go on this bill?
I'm sure that's exactly it. I guess if they were honest, they would call it the Nancy Reagan Biomedic Research Bill. It's not a secret that Nancy Reagan, the First Lady, did not always agree with her husband, and certainly on the larger and broader issue of abortion, there was not agreement. Which this, you know, lends itself to. We understand that she's a grieving widow, and we certainly, our hearts go out to Nancy Reagan. We all watched the funeral, and we're very touched and moved by her grace. I'm sure that perhaps she hasn't really taken a close look at the information that's out there. I think she would see from her husband's own words that there's a little bit more to this than just, just throwing her name in the fray because she's distraught.
Now, the main sponsor for the bill is Senator Jeffrey Schoenberg
Right. Of
Evanston. And I see a quote in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch from House Republican leader Tom Cross. He says that renaming the bill in favor of Ronald Reagan with Ronald Reagan's name is there to create more awareness about the research. Quote, you look at the involvement and the tenacity of Nancy Reagan on the issue, you can't help but think that this is a way to honor her and her family. What do you make of that reason?
Well, it certainly doesn't honor Ronald Reagan, and it's his name that was put on this bill. With all due respect to Tom Cross, I understand he has a child with a chronic disease, as do I, Todd, but he's wrong here on this. This was just unconscionable, especially a Republican leader here in Illinois. Our Republican platform has always stood for the sanctity of life. This is that issue. And for him to do this, to join forces with Barack Obama and Representative Schoenberg is just, I guess it just really surprised me and stunned me. I thought it was unconscionable that he did that.
What you called this bill a clone and kill bill.
Uh-huh.
Let's get into the details. What would this bill require? What would it allow?
Well, the bill in question would promote, and again, some of this research is already being done, but we're talking about actually the funding of it in these bills. But this bill would promote at taxpayer expense with tax money experimentation on human embryos, fetuses, and clones. Okay. Now, the bill does have a restriction in there limiting cloning experimentation to however long they can survive in a petri dish, but it sets no time or places no limits on embryos and fetuses for experimentation. So, for example, the bill would allow researchers to implant X number of embryos in a mother's uterus, grow them to the desired age, harvest them, and dissect them for experimentation. Fetuses up to and during the time of delivery could be killed and used for experimentation. So this is a grievous bill. It's anti-life. It gets to the very core of the sanctity of life issue and sacredness of life, and Ronald Reagan understood that. That's what this bill does. It passed the House, I think it was 60 to 56. So now it is going to the Senate, and this was the renaming it for the Senate debate, I guess. I think I said Representative Senator Schoenberg. But now it is going to the Senate, to the Illinois Senate, for debate as the Ronald Reagan Biomedic Research Bill.
Now, can you gauge the mind of the Illinois State Senate on this issue, on what they are likely to decide, even with a renamed bill like this?
I do not have that information. Do have people down in Springfield. I think it's important that all your listeners, whether they think their senator would favor this or oppose it, I think it's urgent that they all hear from Christians giving our opinions on what this bill does and to oppose this barbaric particular piece of legislation. So I think everybody needs to contact their senators, regardless of whether they think they may be okay or not.
Again, the chief sponsor in the Senate for this bill, Jeffrey Schoenberg, is quoted in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch as saying, "We need to put the politics and the rhetoric aside and enable science to truly take its course." What do you make of this notion that opposition to this is merely politics and rhetoric, and what does science really tell us about the advantages of embryonic stem cell research over those of adult stem cell research, which requires the killing of no one?
Right. I'm glad you mentioned that, because, first of all, making it political, they're the very ones that have made this political by trying to use the name of a former president in a very emotional situation after he had just passed away, and using his widow's support of this. That is what's making this rhetoric and political. We've never wavered on our opposition to this bill at all for the reasons you just said. The embryonic stem cell research arena is actually kind of falling apart, and that's why these research companies are starting to lack funds. And what better place to get more money than from the American taxpayers, or in this case, the Illinois taxpayers? In reality, the adult stem cells is not only more promising, but there have actually been just amazing successes using adult stem cells, and that would include umbilical cord blood stem cells. Just amazing progress has been made in those areas. There's been success in animal tests with adult stem cells on diabetes, Parkinson's, stroke, heart disease, spinal cord injury, and even in human patients, Todd. They've already demonstrated success with adult stem cells for multiple sclerosis, lupus, sickle cell anemia, cartilage damage, growing new corneas to restore sight to blind patients, new blood vessels, repairing heart damage, and it goes on and on and on. And instead, in contrast to that, the embryonic stem cell research has produced zero improvement, not even a little bit of improvement, even in their favorite lab animal, mice, much less in any other animal or human beings. So I think what we're seeing is maybe a panic on the part of those who were pushing embryonic stem cells, and they're running short of money, and they think that the American taxpayer is prime for kind of stirring up the emotional issue of trying to help people with diseases, and certainly we all feel that way, trying to use that to insist to their legislators that embryonic stem cell research be funded by their tax dollar. I think it's a dead end, and science is starting to understand that and admit that in many cases.
Karen, with only 1 minute, what's the bottom line for our listener when it comes to when they read about this deceivingly renamed the Ronald Reagan Biomedical Research Act? What should they know first and foremost?
They should know that Ronald Reagan, in particular, valued life as sacred from conception and would never have agreed to this or lent his name to it, that this is a dangerous bill. House Bill 3589 is a dangerous bill that does allow experimentation on embryos, fetuses, and clones, that they need to call their legislators in Springfield or at their home office. The Springfield number is 217-782-2000. There's tons of information about stem cell research, both adult and the problems with embryonic stem cell research, on CWA's website, which is www.cwfa, stands for Concerned Women for America, .org.
Karen Hayes, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Thanks so much, Todd. It was a pleasure.
Karen Hayes, Associate Director of Concerned Women for America of Illinois. For the next few minutes, Sherry Tyree will be our guest. You might have read her column in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, Tips for Pro-Choice Advocates. Now, I hope that you didn't simply, I hope that you read beyond the headline here, because this is a brilliantly written column. Really want to sell your message? A pro-lifer suggests using promotion, a polished image, honesty, and a sense of humor. We're going to be talking with the author of that column here for the next few minutes of Issues Etc. Sherry Tyree is co-founder of Women for Faith and Family and author of the commentary Tips for Pro-Choice Advocates. Sherry, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd. It's great to be here.
First of all, kudos on a brilliantly conceived concept for a column advocating life under the guise of giving tips to the pro-choicers. Yeah. Why did you approach it this way?
Well, I think it all started about a year ago when my husband and I were in Longboat Key, Florida, and there was an ad in the little island newspaper, the free newspaper. And the ad said, please, well, it didn't say please, but it said, Longboat Key Democratic Club is going to have a speaker, and the topic is going to be President Bush's war on women. I thought, well, that's not language that's likely to gather a large group. And my friend, guests of ours, English guests, one of them said she'd come with us. She said, I'm afraid I'm going to cry. And it turned out she didn't have to be afraid at all because they weren't talking about fetuses. They weren't talking about unborn babies. They were just talking about themselves. And we sat there, and I noticed so many mistakes that they were making from their own point of view. So I've had a year to think about that. And, you know, the Post-Dispatch is a difficult difficult place to talk the way you and I are talking today. So it had to be done a little bit differently. I wanted to talk to my opponents.
Now, to deal with, I think, what might be the obvious criticism initially before we get into the point for point here, Sherry, someone says, why help the other side? Because even if this is meant to be a sidelong and oblique critique of the opposition's methods, their inability to get in touch with the truth and things like that, these still may be helpful hints.
They may very well be, and indeed I thought about that as I was thinking about writing the piece. I decided it was a calculated risk because I've been watching and reading pro-choice arguments, well, certainly for the past 20 years of Women for Faith and Family being in existence, and they show no signs of learning anything. For instance, this latest March for Women's Lives that was right here in 2004, they had another one a decade earlier. It wasn't all that different. They had a whole decade to learn how to package their argument to, as I say in the Post-Dispatch, to Middle America, and they have not done that. So it's a calculated risk.
Let's begin with your first critique of the methods, the rhetoric, and the whatnot of the pro-choice advocates. You start out by suggesting that they lose the hysterical language and endless fevered pitch outrage.
Right.
Give us an example here.
Right. Well, certainly one example was in this ad in Florida. They talked about the president's plan to appoint ultra-conservative judges. That's red flag language. That is meant to, as I say in the article, get the juices flowing in the back room. It is not something that you say in public when you want to appeal to a larger group than you already have. And that's all they do.
Why do you think there is, and I thought about the same thing when I watched, and we covered rather extensively, the March for Women's Lives recently in Washington, D.C. Mm. I thought to myself, you know, the average person is going to be put off by the what you call the fevered pitch, hysterical language and behavior. And I'm wondering, does this denote a lack of confidence that they even are convincing themselves or their base?
I think that their primary goal in having that Take Back the Streets rally, as they put it, was to gather as many people they could for a photo op. And the way they did that was to go to the universities and gather young women. I mean, they strong-armed them. And they got the environmental crowd, and they got the war protesters, and they got every, what you might call, left-wing group they could gather for what I would say to them it was a short-term goal. They got a picture of a lot of people in the paper on the front page above the fold. But, you know, when on looking, as you're pointing out, on looking at this more carefully, they're losing the kind of audience that they want. At least I would think they want.
That goes to another one of your tips here a little later in the list, but it fits right here, and that is do stay on message. What do you mean?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's exactly what, more or less what I've just been saying. I read an article in the New Republic that was published after the march, and it was rather interesting. First of all, it was interesting that the New Republic is about as thin as a church bulletin these days. I thought it was an ad. I didn't realize that it was so thin. At any rate, the article mentioned, the fellow who wrote the article interviewed people who'd gone to the march, and the last woman interviewed said, well, if it were all about abortion, I wouldn't have come. They had to do this to get a large group, but that was just a short-term success and a long-term failure.
You also suggest that they stop attacking the Catholic Church. Why so?
Well, one of the reasons, of course, is that I love the Catholic Church. I am a Catholic, and I think that what the Church teaches is right. In other words, on two levels, they have been literally blasphemous. And as far as I know, I haven't read or heard any apology from this group. They are allowing their people to do stupid things and blasphemous things. And as I say, I love the Church, so I'm going to stick up for it.
You also say that they should not brag publicly about having the media in their pockets.
Yeah, that was interesting. Before deciding to go to that meeting in Florida, I had no idea whether anyone would question us. You know, are you Democrat? Do you vote Democrat? We got in there, and nobody questioned us about anything. There was an assumption, and they make a lot of ungrounded assumptions. They shouldn't do this. For instance, the speaker said, I know you all read the Times. Well, it's kind of silly. It's kind of in, you know, it's an in-group kind of thing. This was an open invitation, and I guess they forgot it was an open invitation. And somebody pro-life noticed that they were bragging about how they have the media in their pocket.
You also suggest, and these two things I think go together in a different, the two different ways of saying the same thing, do get your facts straight and don't lie. Talk about that, if you will.
Well, I think they're different. I think that the fact that they don't even know enough to know that Teddy Roosevelt was, from their viewpoint, a worse president than George W. Bush, that's laziness. I mean, if I know more about this than they do, there's something wrong. But that's kind of minor compared to the lying. There's a long history of lying on their part. I just put two examples in the paper that are rather well-known examples. But there are other examples down the line.
Give us one of those examples with about a minute and a half before we go to this break.
Well, what I wrote in the paper, Dr. Bernard Nathanson, God love him, he started NARAL years and years ago, and he came around finally to walk away not only from NARAL, but to walk away from the whole abortion scene. And he's written books, he's been on TV, he gives talks all over the place, and he's become a Christian. And he really walked a long road. And he has admitted over and over again, we plucked those numbers out of the air to say how many women died before Roe. Of course, there weren't any statistics, you see, so he could get away with that. And then the most recent example is Ron Fitzsimmons, and I imagine he's still with the other side. But I guess the press found him out. He blatantly lied about late-term abortion. And evidently Hillary Clinton doesn't know that he lied because she still quotes him.
Sherry Tyree is our guest, co-founder of Women for Faith and Family. She is author of the commentary in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch today, Tips for Pro-Choice Advocates. We're talking about that commentary and the advice that she's offering to the other side on the issue of life. If you'd like to join us, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. When we come back from this break, we're going to deal with a few more of the pieces of advice that Sherry has for pro-choice advocates, and a couple questions linger then. How likely is it that the pro-choice advocates will take Sherry's advice? And do pro-life advocates also need, from time to time, similar advice? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We'll conclude our conversation with Sherry Tyree. We are far from done. Even though our time begins to dwindle down, we'll also be talking with Diane Nippers here in just a few minutes on the other side of the break about new guidelines that are being circulated among evangelicals from a committee of the National Association of Evangelicals on political involvement. It represents a bit of the, one leading evangelical has called it a maturing of the evangelical public mind. And we'll be rounding off our conversation today with Senator Sarah Steelman about the vote in August against the proposed amendment to the Missouri Constitution on gay marriage.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Let's face it. Most Christians just don't know what to do with the Old Testament book of Leviticus. Does it still apply today? If so, how? How are we to rightly understand the Old Testament law, ceremonial, civil, and moral? Our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for June is the Concordia Commentary on the Book of Leviticus. For more information on this book, visit our website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for June, the Concordia Commentary on the Book of Leviticus. Or order it by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040, or visit our website, issuesetc.org. It's the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for June, the Concordia Commentary on the Book of Leviticus.
Lost Plains and a Young Earth.
Answers with Ken Ham, one of the contributing writers and editors to Creation Magazine. Well, Ken, how could airplanes have anything to do with the age of the Earth?
This is a fascinating story that we reported on. In 1942, during the last World War,
two large B-17 bombers and six P-38 fighter planes ran low on fuel. They had to be landed on the ice of Greenland. Now, the planes were abandoned and basically forgotten until 1988, when a team was assembled to find the planes and retrieve them. After only nearly 50 years, they expected the planes would still be easy to locate. After all, secular scientists have insisted that the ice layers in Greenland had laid down over millions of years. But the recovery team was perplexed when they couldn't find the planes. After a lot of searching, they finally located all eight planes, 3 miles away from where they were landed and 250 feet deep in the ice. No one expected that this thickness of ice could have accumulated so quickly in only 60 years. At such a rate of accumulation, it wouldn't have taken the supposed millions of years to accumulate the ice layers in the Arctic or Antarctic. It's just another of the many indicators that this Earth isn't that old, just as expected from taking the Bible as literal history.
There's more fascinating evidence that shows the Earth is young, not old. Read our free booklet on our website, AnswersRadio.com. It's a free service of AnswersRadio.com.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. Children surfing the net can accidentally come across sites that are racist, violent, or pornographic. Some sites will even bribe your child with the promise of free prizes in exchange for personal information. Some sites may even try to arrange personal meetings with your child. Software filters can be helpful in blocking out unwanted sites, but there is no substitute for keeping your home computer in a central location so you can easily monitor where your children are going online. Remember, God loves our children so much that He sent Jesus to die for them, and He also guards and protects them from sin and every evil. And one way He does that is through the watchful eyes of Christian parents. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute. Please visit our website at cmli.org.
You probably own life insurance to protect your loved ones. As your children grow up, their need for protection changes. Your life insurance can be an excellent way to include a gift for the Lord's work through KFUO in your estate plan. Your gift can be made by simply including KFUO as a beneficiary on your life insurance. If you are interested in including a gift to KFUO and the Lord's work in your life insurance, call Janelle Flerke at 888-930-4438.
Tomorrow on Issues, Etc., The Da Vinci Code with Dr. Peter Jones of Westminster Seminary. That will be tomorrow on the program. We're talking with Sherry Tyree. She is author of the commentary that appeared in today's St. Louis Post-Dispatch, Tips for Pro-Choice Advocates. She's co-founder of Women for Faith and Family. Sherry, before we go on to the next tips and round off our conversation here, you mentioned something before the break. I'd like you to clarify it.
Mm-hmm.
Under the piece of advice, get your facts straight. You say that the pro-choice advocates often portray George W. Bush as the worst president for women's rights in the history of this country. That's a quote from them. Your point there on whether or not George W. Bush really is the worst women from their the worst president from their perspective, and Teddy Roosevelt.
Well, the point that this might have gotten garbled in the editing in the paper, but the point is that from their point of view, Teddy Roosevelt would be worse because not only did he think abortion was murder, he actually thought contraception was akin to murder. And anybody can look that up on Google or any other of the search engines and find that out.
Another piece of advice that you offer the pro-choice advocates is don't lard your communication with legalisms. What do you mean by this?
Well, you know, we make all sorts of points that we, the pro-lifers, that have to do with the human family, the human community, the humanity of the unborn child. Then when it's their turn, whether they're on TV or what have you, all they talk about is the law, which, of course, we all have to talk about, but they do it way too much. Most of us do not understand the finite aspects of the law and how everything's going to go and be appealed and then whatever. As I keep getting back to, they have to appeal to the big middle. The big middle does not want to talk or hear about the law, necessarily. It's obvious that the middle is very confused about what Roe v. Wade actually
Roe v. Wade does or says anyway. So I would, you know, if I were on their team, I would say, let's cut back on this.
Do pro-choice advocates engage pro-life arguments?
Absolutely not. And that I find fascinating. They are simply pretending we do not exist and hoping that somehow we go away. This was true during that. It was a long meeting. It was a long talk in Florida. And the only insightful question that was asked, this was after a rather boring talk given by the Planned Parenthood CEO. The first question was quite insightful, and that was, why is it that young women are not supporting abortion rights? And the answer, which could have been fascinating, was not. It was a defense of Planned Parenthood. The speaker took this as an attack on her, and she said, oh, we're going back into the colleges and we're going to rev up the girls and that kind of thing. And from then on, they did not talk about anything. They didn't talk, as I said before, they didn't talk about the fetus. They never uttered the word child. No unborn child. They never mentioned 4D ultrasound. They never mentioned the fact that lots of abortionists in this country are in deep trouble with the law. They didn't talk about the statutory rape concerns with all these underage girls being given advice by counselors at Planned Parenthood to do this, do that, whatever, even though it's against the law. They simply don't deal with it.
Folks, you can read this commentary in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. It's by Sherry Tyree. It's called Tips for Pro-Choice Advocates. There's a little bit more there, and I'll leave that for your reading. Very interesting stuff and very well done. And you can also read it on the web at stltoday.com. stltoday.com. It's called Tips for Pro-Choice Advocates. Sherry Tyree, thank you for being our guest.
Thank you so much.
Now, speaking of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, did you see the story on today's front page? It was titled, Evangelical Association Rethinks Its Agenda. Earlier today, I had an opportunity to talk with Diane Nippers of the Institute on Religion and Democracy based in Washington, D.C., about this rethinking of their political agenda among evangelicals. I began by asking Diane about what occasioned a new document that is being circulated among evangelicals on political actions.
Well, the whole process started about 3 years ago when we realized that the National Association of Evangelicals was involved in public policy advocacy, and we wanted to step back and look at our involvement and try to find ways to make it more participatory and broad-based and frankly, more effective.
Was there a concern, Diane, that the National Association of Evangelicals in particular, and that evangelicals as a broader group in the United States, were becoming stereotyped too closely associated with politics of a certain particular kind?
Well, that's one concern, but then there's also the concern that there are still many evangelicals who are uncomfortable with political engagement at all. There were concerns that we are being misrepresented in the media. And just concerns too that sometimes we fail to do our homework and fail to take advantage of the opportunities that we have. And then there were internal issues too. We wanted to make sure that a part of this process eventually will say, you know, our various constituencies involved in public policy statements. For example, the missionary community that has a lot of contacts with people abroad, are we really hearing their voice and their perspective?
How would you characterize the contents of this draft proposal for the National Association of Evangelicals on Political Action?
Well, it includes some general principles that should guide our engagement. We certainly want our public policy engagement to be biblically based and well-researched and that sort of thing. And then it talks about some specific issues. And it's really a cross-section of things that evangelicals are concerned about, everything from our concern for the poor to concern for family life to protect the sanctity of human life, the care for God's creation, just a broad spectrum of issues.
Some might see this document as a move to the left for the National Association of Evangelicals. How would you respond to that, Diane?
I don't think it is at all. And people who see that, I think, are have either misunderstood the NAE or are projecting into it. The NAE, you know, there are issues where evangelicals have a broad consensus, and there's a broad consensus on abortion, for example. There's a broad consensus that marriage should be the union of one man and one woman, and that consensus is reflected in this paper. There are also issues about which evangelicals disagree, and two in particular have to do with war and peace. There are many evangelicals who are pacifists. There are more of us who are just war, in the just war tradition, but that's a definite difference in the evangelical community. And the other difference is around how involved government should be in social welfare. So while we all agree that as Christians we should be concerned about the poor, we disagree about whether certain things should be the responsibility of the federal government or state governments or the private sector.
I'm interested in a quote that appeared in the Los Angeles Times that happened to get a copy of the draft proposal. And they quote, at least in part here, saying that the framework says that Christians in their devotion to country, quote, must be careful to avoid the excesses of nationalism, must guard against identifying Christian social goals with single party politics, lest non-believers think that the Christian faith is essentially political in nature. What does that mean?
A couple of things. First of all, this is a draft in progress, and it's the entire document. We just had a previously scheduled conference call to take advantage of feedback we had gotten, and now we are in the process of releasing it to get information from the broad public. So, in fact, one of those we did change slightly. Let me take first the point about nationalism. We make the point that Christianity is a global faith, and that we have we all have a prior commitment to the kingdom of God. But we also recognize that there is a legitimate form of patriotism, of love of country, and certainly we applaud representative democracy. But at the same time, that doesn't mean that everything our nation does pleases God. And so we want to avoid, that's what we mean by excessive nationalism, that America is not the kingdom of God. So we recognize that difference and also recognize that it's legitimate for human beings to be patriotic and to love their country. Regarding political parties, we want people to be involved in their political parties, and we've changed the document to encourage involvement in political parties and unashamed propagation of biblical views within that system. At the same time, we don't think it's healthy for the church to be identified with partisan politics. So individuals may be involved in partisan politics, but we don't want the church identified that way.
Diane Nippers is our guest, president of the Institute on Religion and Democracy based in Washington, D.C. She co-chaired the drafting committee for this framework for political action being proposed and circulated by the National Association of Evangelicals. Diane, one thing that is very curious is the amount of media attention that's being given to this document. The place I found it, front page of our local St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Mm-hmm. Why the attention from the media?
Well, this is a political year. And, you know, this document is, as I said, it's been in preparation for 3 years. There's going to be a book that's a part of the process that won't be available till next spring. So, you know, we've been working on it all along, but obviously the media is looking at it from the point of view of elections and are, I think, trying to, frankly, make more of this in a partisan sense than ought to exist. But, it, you know, it's election year, so it's not an unusual thing for the media to do.
How likely will this document be accepted by the National Association of Evangelicals? And if it is accepted, what will that mean? What force, what gravity will it have in all of the disparate groups that make up the National Association of Evangelicals?
Well, I think that it will certainly help us internally to set priorities for the kinds of things that we're concerned about. I think it's likely that a version of it will. I'm really excited about seeing that, you know, later on this week it's going to be up on the NAE website, and we're soliciting comments. We would like, we want this to represent a broad consensus of evangelicals, and, you know, the drafting committee is at this point really eager to see what the grassroots say, you know, about the document.
Richard Mao, president of Fuller Theological Seminary, is quoted in the press as describing this document as a maturing of the evangelical public mind. What do you think Richard Mao means there?
Well, from my point of view, evangelicals in the mid-20th century just finally began to understand that they should be politically engaged. In the 70s and 80s, our engagement was very much issue-driven around, you know, specific concerns, specific issues. And I think now that evangelicals understand that political engagement isn't a matter simply of a campaign, say, on the abortion issue, but that we need to be broadly involved in the political process. We need to encourage evangelicals to run for office or to work for people, you know, work in the three branches of government here in Washington, you know, down to grassroots engagement in the political process. You know, there's a particular difficulty. While on the one hand we don't want the church associated with partisan politics, at the same time there is a pretty significant divide, a growing polarization in our nation around some issues, particularly around life and around marriage. And, you know, there's no question that, particularly on the pro-life issue, that evangelicals will be attracted to the Republican Party. You know, but I would hope that there could be a broadening of the Democratic Party so that pro-life people would be welcome there, so that we really could have a Christian and an evangelical influence in both the political parties.
Finally, Diane, where does this document go from here?
Well, as I said, we're going to put it on the NAE website, and other evangelical groups are going to put it on their websites, and we are soliciting broad grassroots input in the document. And then later on this summer, the committee will revise it again using that input and take it to the NAE Board of Directors in October. And once they've signed off on the document, we're going to invite a cross-section of evangelical leaders to sign the statement for final release along with the book next spring.
Diane Nippers is president of the Institute on Religion and Democracy based in Washington, D.C. Diane, thank you again for being our guest on Issues, Etc.
Thank you.
Diane Nippers also co-chaired the committee of the National Association of Evangelicals that put this document together. We're joined for the last few minutes of Issues, Etc. by Senator Sarah Steelman. She was on the program recently talking about something she'd written in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Today we have her on to explain how it is that the vote for the proposed amendment to the Missouri Constitution to ban gay marriage, originally to be in November, on the November ballot, along with so many other important things, has been moved to August. Senator Sarah Steelman is a sponsor of the Marriage Protection Amendment. Senator, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Thank you, Todd. It's good to be on again.
How did this happen, Senator, that a vote that should have been in November was pushed to August?
Well, as you correctly said, the resolution was, as I had written it, was supposed to be in November, held in November. However, the Constitution does allow for the governor to set a special election if he so chooses, which he did. And he chose August to put it on the ballot.
So I take it, at least according to the story in MSNBC, as I'm looking at their website, the Missouri Supreme Court exerted some kind of pressure on Secretary of State Matt Blunt to enact this. Is that correct?
Well, that's right. The way it worked was really the Secretary of State, because the bill was passed so late in session, could not fulfill his statutory obligations to get it on the August ballot. So he said it needed to be on the November ballot. It took it all the way to the Missouri Supreme Court, and the Missouri Supreme Court said that the governor had the right by the Constitution to put it on the August ballot, despite the fact that we cannot fulfill the statutory obligations required for ballot issues. There's a timeline. There's several things that you have to do. You have to publicize it. You have to get a good fiscal note on it. And so, you know, Todd, it kind of illustrates why we actually need the marriage amendment. Because, again, the courts looked at the Constitution over the statute. That's why we need a constitutional amendment defining marriage, so that that would preempt any statutory reinterpretation by a judge.
Senator Steelman, who opposed voting on the amendment to the Constitution in November, and why?
Well, it's my understanding that Governor Holden does not support the ballot measures, the amendment to the Constitution, and he put it on the August ballot. I think it was unfortunate because there's more people who get out and vote in November, and it'd be a broader representation of the population. And I think it was very unfortunate that he made that decision.
So what will it mean that the voters in Missouri will need to go to the polls at a special occasion in August rather than when they would normally be going for the general election in November? What will it mean for the proposed amendment to the Missouri Constitution?
Well, I still think that the proposed amendment will pass, but it makes it more important for your listeners and those people who support the definition of marriage as only between a man and a woman, which is what the amendment says, to get out and vote yes in August. We need to get the word out that it is a yes vote on the definition. I think there's some movement by the opposition to confuse voters to make it unclear as to whether to vote yes or no. It's a yes vote because it does define marriage as only between a man and a woman. And we need to get as many people out there. I was listening to your program before I got on grassroots efforts. This needs to, if you can spread the word, it would sure help to make sure people get out and vote on August 3rd in the primary election.
Could this actually work in favor of those who are in favor of the amendment, as I'm sure you are as well, of course? Could it actually work in favor in that this move to try and make the vote more obscure, if you will, and difficult to make, could actually activate those who would say, hey, it's a general election, lots of people are going to be at the polls. Now they know in August they have to be at the polls if they want this amendment to the Constitution.
I think it'll only help if people are educated and know how to vote in August. Maybe I didn't understand your question.
Well, correctly. I guess in other words, I'm thinking in terms of if I were a resident of Missouri, and if we're going to be in November, I'd say to myself, well, you know, there'll be lots of pro-lifers out there, or there'll be lots of advocates against gay marriage out there. Maybe I can stay home. But if it's in August, and I know it's that important, then I will be at the polls.
Well, I hope that's true. I hope that is what happens. And maybe it will get more people out to vote who feel very strongly about this issue, and I think Missourians do feel strongly about this issue. And so if it gets more people out to vote, that's always a good thing.
Tell us specifically, with only about a minute here, what will Missourians be voting on in August at this special election?
They will be voting on an amendment to the Missouri Constitution that defines marriage as being valid in this state as only between a man and a woman, and that is a yes vote to an affirmative vote on that definition of marriage. That's on August 3rd.
And if that August 3rd vote goes in favor of the amendment to the Constitution, what will that do about the issue of gay marriage in the state of Missouri?
Then that will add a further protection to our Constitution, which will not allow gay marriages here in this state.
Senator Sarah Steelman, keep up the good work. Expect to see you, along with many of our listeners, out there at the polls on August 3rd voting yes in favor of the constitutional amendment to ban gay marriage.
Yes, she will. Thank you so much, Todd, for having me on.
Senator Sarah Steelman, she sponsored the Marriage Protection Amendment, talking about that August 3rd vote. We need to pay attention to these kind of nuts and bolts things to vote yes in favor of a Missouri state constitutional amendment to ban gay marriage. We have just a few minutes here. Let me tell you about our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June. We talked earlier about the United Church of Christ and the way they're straying on this kind of issue and leading the way far out ahead of the culture, radical thinking on what the difference between the various sexualities are, trying to talk now about marriage being defunct as an institution for heterosexuals and homosexuals. What does a church like that need? You know what it needs? Solid biblical scholarship. Scholarship that takes the Word of God seriously as the Word of God, and more than that, that not only on the moral issues, but also on the real issue of Scripture, finds Christ on every page. That's what our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June does. It's the Concordia Commentary on the Book of Leviticus. There's one of those books that, although it may seem obscure, has some pretty clear teaching on the issue of homosexuality, doesn't it? It's the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June, the Concordia Commentary on Leviticus. You can have the book by calling Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. You'll find out information there about the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June, the Concordia Commentary on Leviticus, 1-800-325-3040. I want to remind you, tune in tonight. Don't forget, if you missed something today already, we had a tremendous first hour here on Issues Etc. Gretchen Passantino was our guest. We talked about Christians and critical thinking. We also discussed a leader in the 19th century holiness movement, Phoebe Palmer. Our guest was Chris Armstrong of Christian History Magazine. Now, you can hear all of that tonight from 8 to 9 here on AM 850 KFUO. The broadcast, the rebroadcast for the first hour of Issues Etc. from 8 to 9 here on AM 850 KFUO. And tomorrow on the program, tune in again at 3 o'clock. We'll be talking about the Da Vinci Code with Dr. Peter Jones of Westminster Seminary. Don't forget, 8 to 9 tonight, listen for that first hour with Gretchen Passantino and Chris Armstrong of Christian History Magazine. An excellent first hour rebroadcast from 8 to 9 here on AM 850 KFUO. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.